Short story number 27, Sailing the Star by Larry Vardaman. Larry was deeply engaged in reading Patrick O'Brien's book titled HMS Surprise, one in a series of historical novels about the Napoleonic Wars. The stories were exciting, swashbuckling sagas of a fictitious Admiral Nelson-like British sea captain by the name of Jack Aubrey, who successfully fought the French in a square-rigged sailing ship, like the Star of India, anchored at the Embarcadero in downtown San Diego. Larry had been aboard the Star several times and had begun to recognize the complexity of sea battles fought in the early 1800s. He identified with Jack Aubrey, the fictitious sea captain, who commanded the Surprise. As he read, his imagination transformed him into the role of Captain Jack. Jack, captain of the Surprise, Storton, his lieutenant, and Etheridge, commander of the Marines, were on the quarterdeck. Harrowby, the executive officer, stood a little behind them, conning the ship. The other officers were at the guns, each to his own division. Every man silently watched the Berceau as she ran down, a beautiful trim little ship with scarlet topsides. She was head-on now, coming for the Surprise's broadsides, and Jack, watching closely through his glass, could see no sign of her meaning to bear up. The half-minute signal gun beside him spoke out again and again and again, yet still the Berceau came on in the certainty of a murderous raking fire. This was more determination than he had ever reckoned on. He had once done the same himself in the Mediterranean, but that was against a Spanish frigate. Another 200 yards and his heavy carronades would reach the Berceau point blank. The signal gun again and again. "Belay there," he said, and much louder, "Mr. Pullings, Mr. Pullings." A steady, deliberate fire now. Let the smoke clear between each shot. Point low on her foremast. A pause, and on the upward roll, the purser's gun crashed out, the smoke sweeping ahead. A hole appeared in the corvette's spritzel, and a cheer went up, drowned by the second gun. "Steady! Steady!" roared Jack, and Pullings ran down the line to point the third. The ball crashed close to the corvette's bow, and as it splashed, she answered with a shot from her chaser that struck the mainmast of a glancing blow. The firing came down the line, a rippling broadside. Two shots went home in the corvette's bows. Another hit her chains, and there were holes in her foresail. Now it began forward, and as the range narrowed, so they hit her hard with almost every shot or swept her deck from stem to stern. There were two guns dismounted aboard her and several men lying on the deck. Broadside after broadside, the whole ship quivering in the thunder. The jets of flame, the thick powder smoke racing ahead. Still, the Berceau held on, though her way was checked, and now her bow guns answered with chain shot that shrieked high through the riggings, cutting ropes and sails as it went. "Can he mean to lay me aboard?" thought Jack. "Mr. Pullings, Mr. Bamington, briskly now, and grape the next round. Mr. Etheridge, the Marines may..." His words were cut off by a furious cheer. The Berceau's foremast was going. It gave a great forward lurch. The stays and the shrouds parted, and it fell in a ruin of canvas, masking the corvette's forward guns. "Hold hard," he cried. "Main top there, let go." The Surprise's topsail billowed out, came down, and collapsed, and across the water they heard a thin answering cheer from the shattered corvette. A forward gun sent a hail of grape along the Berceau's deck, knocking down a dozen men and cutting away their colors. "Cease fire there! Rot you all in hell!" cried Jack. "Secure those guns, Mr. Storton. Hands the knot and splice!" Splice. She struck, said a voice in the waist as the surprise swept on. The Berceau, hulled again and again, low in the water and by the head, swung heavily around, and they saw a figure running up the mizzen shrouds with fresh colors. Jack took his hat off to the captain, standing there on his bloody quarter-deck 70 yards away. The Frenchman returned the salute, but still, as his remaining larboard guns came to bear, he fired a ragged broadside after the surprise, and then, as she reached the limit of his range, another and a last attempt at preventing her escape. A vain attempt. Not a shot came home. Larry looked up from his book as he heard something strike the front porch. At first, he thought it was a stray cannonball, but upon recognizing the familiar red-painted front door of his living room, as he emerged slowly from the images of a naval battle on the surprise, he realized it was just the evening edition of the San Diego Union Tribune hitting the screen door, thrown by the paperboy. He reluctantly tore himself away from the drama of vanquishing a French warship, opened the screen, picked up the paper, and quickly glanced at the front page. He was about to toss the paper aside and return to the Napoleonic era when his eye caught a glimpse of the Star of India just below the fold on the front page. The image of the old three-masted schooner always stirred his pulse a bit, so he looked closer at the short article below the picture. As he read the first few lines, the following words popped out. The Star is recruiting crewmen. Report for 6 weeks of training in April and May. 20 new crewmen will be selected. You've got to be kidding, he thought. The Star is recruiting new crew members? That's incredible. I thought they'd have had more than enough volunteers to man the ship the few times she goes to sea each year. The Star was normally tied up at the dock along the Embarcadero in downtown San Diego, where tourists could visit her each day. Once or twice a year, on special occasions, however, she was towed 10 miles out of the harbor past Point Loma, where she sailed for a couple of hours. Although the USS Constitution, in Boston, is the oldest square-rigged sailing ship still afloat, she doesn't actually sail when towed out to sea. She's too fragile because her old wooden beams can't stand the strain. The Star, on the other hand, being constructed of iron, is strong enough to actually get underway with full sail. When she flies, the Star is a magnificent sight to see on a sunny day, a cloud of white over the blue of the ocean. From jibs in the front, foresails, mainsails, and mizzen sails in the middle, to the spanker in the stern, and from staysails near the deck to topsails and topgallants above, some 20 sails in all. It takes a crew of over 50 sailors to hoist and adjust the sails when underway. Maybe this is my chance to actually sail on a tall ship, as large old sailing ships are called, Larry thought. I'll get my name on the list right away. So, Larry signed up and was told to report for duty at 9 a.m. on the first Saturday in April for the five following Saturdays. Arriving on the deck of the Star that first day was glorious. There were men running everywhere, getting everything shipshape. Hundreds of ropes were lay coiled on the deck and tied to the rails. Sails were fluttering in the breeze. Excitement was in the air. Larry was going to become a crewman on the Star of India. But then the hard work began. Volunteers were broken into four groups that rotated between instructors, so each person could get more hands-on training. One group was taught how to tie knots. A second group learned the ropes, that is, how to coil a rope and what sails they were tied to. A third group memorized the names and functions of over 20 sails. And the fourth group attempted to pass the qualifying physical exams. Larry knew he was in trouble when he learned what the qualifying tests required. The first test was to be able to lift a 200-pound bag of sand to a shelf 15 feet above the floor with a pulley. He passed that test easily, but the second was harder, 30 pull-ups in less than 2 minutes. And the third was harder still, climbing a 2-inch rope 30 feet above the floor. He hadn't done either of these exercises since high school and was barely able to do it then. He tried and failed tests 2 and 3 for several weeks, and eventually it became evident it wasn't going to happen. Finally, he quit after the 5th week, after realizing his upper body strength just wasn't enough to pull his 250-pound weight up the rope. The sad part was that he never even got to try the 4th test, climbing up the rigging into the crow's nest, leaning 45 degrees outward beneath the platform. It was painfully apparent that if he couldn't manage to climb a vertical rope, there was no way he could ever get into the crow's nest. A major part of being a sailor was climbing the rigging to unfurl the sheets, 75 feet above the deck. Such work was dangerous, and everyone aloft needed to be in tip-top condition. It was good that the tests were rigorous to avoid unqualified sailors in the rigging, but it was hard giving up the dream of standing on the spars ready to respond to the captain's command to drop the sheets, or being part of a crew assembled to sing sea chanties as they raised the anchor, or lifting the sails by pulling on ropes together. Oh well, maybe the sailor's life was meant for younger, lighter men. We watched from shore as the Star sailed on the 4th of July, the first time after missing the cut to be a crewman. Jeanette and I watched her from Point Loma as she headed to open water, raised her sails, and floated across the waves. What a beautiful sight. He had missed a wonderful opportunity to experience a bit of history. But a few weeks later, he received a letter from the San Diego Maritime Museum, the organization that administered the maintenance and operation of the Star. Larry figured it was an appeal for funds and almost dropped it in the trash, but he thought better of it when he noticed the envelope was gilded in gold. He opened the letter and was shocked when he read the following. "Mr. Vardaman, your name was selected in a drawing of those persons who tried for crew on the Star of India in April of 2001. You were invited to be our guest with a friend for a special sailing on September the 16th, 2001. "What? That's incredible!" He shouted to Jeanette from the front of the house. "We're sailing on the Star," he yelled. "And I don't have to crew the ship. We're guests on the quarterdeck." When the day came to sail on the Star, Larry and Jeanette arrived early, presented the invitation, and were welcomed aboard. It was a glorious day. They were treated as royalty. Throughout the day, oysters on the half shell, fresh boiled shrimp, crab, and lobster were served on ice in the galley. Preferred seating near the rails was available when the crew wasn't running lines across the deck, and he didn't have to raise a finger to hoist the sail or the anchor. The ship was towed by tugboat out past Point Loma and sailed free as a bird for 2 hours on the briny deep. Finally, they made it back to the port after blocking the way of a U.S. Navy missile cruiser in the harbor while the crew practiced lowering and raising the anchor in the center of the channel. The day would have been even better if it hadn't been clouded by a disastrous event earlier in the week. The sailing occurred on Sunday following the destruction of the Twin Towers in New York City the previous Tuesday. The decision had been made to sail the Star even with all the fear, uncertainty, and confusion of the week. The atmosphere was tense and peculiar, mainly because there were no commercial flights in and out of Lindbergh Field near or close to San Diego Bay. However, there were many military aircraft from North Island Naval Air Station and Miramar on patrol. They felt like the Star was part of an armada protecting San Diego from an unknown threat. The voyage on the Star was Larry's only adventure in swashbuckling, but it was enough. He has been more than satisfied to swashbuckle from his easy chair at home with Patrick O'Brien for the past 20 years.